www.ibc.tw/en.
The headlines. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps is holding the second and final day of massive military exercises in central Iran. Hamas welcomes an announcement about parliamentary and presidential elections in Palestinian territories later this year, the first such vote in 15 years. And India launches one of the largest coronavirus vaccination campaigns in an attempt to contain the pandemic in the populous country. Welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps is holding the second and final day of massive military exercises in central Iran. During the drills, the IRGC targeted and destroyed the mock enemy vessels in the Indian Ocean with long-range ballistic missiles. Chairman of the Chiefs of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, said that Iran does not intend to attack any country. However, he said that the country's armed forces will respond with all its might in the shortest time if any adversary had malicious intentions towards the Islamic Republic. The first stage of the IRGC maneuvers kicked off on Friday with firing surface-to-surface ballistic missiles and operating bomber drones. The missiles equipped with detachable warheads are guided from outer space and are able to penetrate into the enemy's missile shield. Time now for the news review of this bulletin. Hello and welcome to the news review. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has announced elections, the first in 15 years, to take place later this year. According to a decree issued by Abbas's office, the legislative elections will be held on May 22nd, while a presidential vote on July 31st. According to the decree, the election will take place in all Palestinian territories. Meanwhile, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has welcomed the announcement. It says it has worked in the past months to resolve all obstacles in the way of elections.
Hamas assured its extreme eagerness that this process should be successful to fulfill the benefits for the Palestinian people who have the right to choose their representatives. We worked in the past months to hammer down all obstacles so that we can reach this day. Because we believe that the nation owns the custody and the people should choose their representatives.
The Hamas spokesperson stressed that the elections should be free or fair and transparent, in which voters can express themselves without pressure and restrictions. Palestinians' last parliamentary ballot in 2006 resulted in a landslide win for Hamas, but the rival Fatah movement later rejected the result and seized control of the West Bank. Ashraf Shannon is our correspondent joining us from Gaza to give us the latest on that, and Saad Nim, professor at political science at Birzeit University, who joins us from Ramallah. Okay, Ashraf, over to you first. Fill us in on what is a monumental and perhaps very significant event that's going to take place the first in 15 years, and these are the elections. Tell us news from both sides, Hamas and Fatah.
Well, the significance of these elections that they come after 15 years, especially that during that time there was a rift between the rival factions, Fatah and Hamas. Palestinians, especially in Gaza, are still skeptic about the success of such elections, especially amid the complex problems between Fatah and Hamas, and also there is a fear of an Israeli intervention that could torpedo these elections. And we also have to keep in mind that following Hamas's overwhelmingly winning the legislative elections in 2006, it was boycotted by Western countries, and also the siege on Gaza was imposed in a very hermetic way. And it remains to be seen if these elections will succeed. We have to also keep in mind that the last time the Palestinian factions were edging closer to elections, and that was in May 2014. Israel waged the war on Gaza and torpedoed the whole thing.
Well, Sutner, to begin with, tell us why you think the elections are taking place at this time.
As a matter of fact, for many reasons, now the elections became due and very important. The first thing, it's because it's due because last elections we had for presidential elections, it was 2005, and for the parliamentary elections, it was 2006. So we are talking between 15 to 16 years last elections happened, and according to the Palestinian, supposed to be the constitution, it's supposed to be every 4 years as it happened, but the circumstances in Palestine was very difficult the last years, and that prevented the elections of taking place, and especially with the partition between Gaza and West Bank and Hamas and Fatah. The second reason, which is equally important, that it is important for the reconciliation between all Palestinian factions, and especially between Fatah and Hamas. The separation between Gaza and West Bank now is due to be ended by the elections, and the elections should bring up a new era between Fatah and Hamas, that they hope that the elections will bring up again a Palestinian leadership for the Palestinian government and the Palestinian Legislative Council, which would help a lot in the ending the partition between Gaza and West Bank, and the reconciliation between all Palestinian factions after these elections. And the third and important also reason is that the Palestinian felt that in the international community is asking the Palestinian also to have these elections, because they lost their authority over the years. Since there was no elections for quite a while, they need to make an elections to make sure that the Palestinian leaders who are maybe in connection with the international community asking for negotiations or asking for a Palestinian state, to have the credibility of their authority by these elections, which became very important, especially with the European Union pushing quite hard. And apparently some talks with Biden administration even before he took place in the American administration, apparently they hinted to the Palestinian that they should have elections, and they should be a real representative to their people if they want to have a good relationship and to restart this relationship with the United States. So the Palestinian, on all these accounts, they needed this election, which became really very important also for the Palestinian people.
Ashraf, you perhaps know very well about differences that exist between Hamas and Fatah. If you can tell us whether those differences still exist and what they are, and whether it will be reconciled, if there are any.
Well, one of the main problems is Hamas movement does not recognize the Israeli regime, and Fatah does. And I think this will become a problem during these elections, and also the fact that the West Bank is occupied. And the Jerusalem Post is occupied, and Gaza is under siege. And it remains to be seen how these elections will be fulfilled, whether in the parliamentary elections in May or the presidential elections in late July.
And Saad Nimra, in terms of whoever gets elected, do you think that it'll make a difference for the lives of Palestinians, especially in the occupied territories, and of course the Gaza Strip that's under siege, and the way that Israel conducts itself against Palestinians?
Well, I don't think that the elections itself will make any difference for the relationship between Israel and the Palestinians. The Israelis have a plan in their mind, and they are going ahead with it in so many different ways, whether it's Trump administration or Biden administration. They are trying to go ahead with it. I don't think that the Palestinian elections would prevent that in anyhow. But at the same time, that will give credibility to the Palestinians anyway internationally, and they hope that the international community in this case will be more clear in pressurizing Israel over so many of its actions against the Palestinians, especially in the land grabbing and confiscation of land and the annexation plans that they are planning for a while now. So I think that the election will help the Palestinians on that level. But in the direct relationship between Israel and the Palestinians, I don't think that the elections will make any difference. However, for the Palestinians themselves, as Ashraf has just mentioned, that would help to ease the siege on Gaza, at least from the Palestinian side, and that will give more help to Gaza under the siege. But to break the siege totally by the Israeli is something we need, you know, to have to mobilize a lot of international pressure on the Israeli to lift the siege on Gaza, and that definitely the elections in this case would help a little bit in unifying the Palestinians under one government, and that should make, you know, a kind of a legal a claim by the Palestinian against the Israeli siege on Gaza.
Thank you for that, Sadnim, Professor of Political Science at Brzez University. Ashraf Shannon, many thanks, a correspondent there from Gaza. And that does it for our news review. Thanks for tuning in. Welcome back. India has started the world's biggest COVID vaccination drive with the aim of protecting its 1.3 billion population from the deadly disease. Prime Minister Narendra Modi launched a campaign addressing medical workers via video conference. Around 300,000 people who get the shots on the first day, starting with healthcare workers and people aged above 50. Officials hope that 300 million people would be inoculated by early August. Recently, the government approved the use of two vaccines. One of them is jointly developed by AstraZeneca and Oxford University, while another developed by local pharmaceutical firm Bharat Biotech. India is the world's second most infected nation, with more than 10 million coronavirus cases and almost 150,000 deaths. Our correspondent in New Delhi, Munawar Zaman, says only time will tell whether the mass vaccination program will make Indians immune to the COVID-19 virus.
There are a lot of concerns about the vaccine, but there's nothing we can say at the moment, because as soon as the vaccine starts rollout, it might show its impact, because we all know every medicine has its effects or side effects. So many medical experts here say it is safe, but we can't jump to any conclusion at the moment. There are two vaccine shots that has to be given within 28 days. The first vaccine shot, which started today, will mean somebody getting a vaccine shot today. It is compulsory and important for him to get the second vaccine shot after 28 days. But now there are so many speculations and so many rumors about the possible impact or side effects of the vaccine. And many people are pretty scared, while some are coming on the TV and showing themselves to be getting vaccinated. In fact, the largest hospital in India, the All India Institute of Medical Sciences, its director was shown on TV giving the first vaccine shot, and one more official from the Planning Commission was getting a vaccine shot. Many parliament members were seen giving vaccine shot, but people still are not sure, because we're not exactly sure how the vaccine, what the vaccine does inside.
As Italy has passed the 1 million mark for vaccinations, there's concern among health authorities that public skepticism over COVID-19 vaccines could undermine the country's fight against the coronavirus pandemic. Max Civoli reports.
Italy topped 1 million COVID jabs since the start of the vaccination campaign on December 31st, according to the latest data, out of over 1.5 million doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine delivered across the country since December 27, more than 60% have already been injected, the highest number of first doses administered in the EU. However, some Italian media have been warning in recent days about an increasing number of medics and health workers not willing to be vaccinated.
Vaccination rate among health workers is quite high, however, about 10% of medical staff remain very skeptical. The lack of testing is one of people's main concerns. We are observing the effects of the vaccine while it's being administered.
A poll released in mid-December caused surprise in Italy by showing that one-third of the population were not willing to be vaccinated, along with half of nurses and other health workers.
I have my reservations over the vaccine because the matter has not been discussed much yet. I would have injected only if it becomes obligatory.
New polls are showing the scenario seems to have changed in recent days, with more Italians willing to receive the coronavirus vaccine. Medics promoting anti-vaccination propaganda had been warned or disciplined by doctors' associations.
Doctors' guilds in Italy have been conducting inquiries into medics accused of unwarranted criticism of vaccinations. Tens of medics have been punished with measures ranging from warnings to two-month suspensions.
Doctors' guilds' actions being timely and appropriate. Unfortunately, some medics should be trained on how to express their views on social platforms, as they aren't aware of the consequences of their inflammatory posts.
Meanwhile, a joint report by the Health Ministry and the Higher Health Institute is warning the COVID-19 epidemic in Italy risks becoming uncontrolled as the virus RT reproduction number has been increasing for 5 weeks straight. The country's COVID-19 death toll has risen to over 81,000. Max Civili, Rome.
U.S. state capitals are being fortified amid fears of possible armed attacks in the days leading up to the inauguration of President-elect Joe Biden. High security fences are erected around government and federal buildings. The governor of Florida has called up the National Guard to support local and state law enforcement. In the capital, Washington, D.C., officials have taken unprecedented security measures, including the deployment of up to 25,000 National Guard troops and road closures. The D.C. mayor says the city will have to maintain heightened security even after the presidential inauguration.
I'm sad about it. I have to tell you that it looks that way. I'm committed to making sure that we get our city back. Our visitors, our residents, our workers will be able to get through the city with ease. But I also know that we have a special responsibility, that there is a peaceful transition of power in our country. We're proud in Washington to host the federal government. And we want to make sure that event is peaceful.
Bowser said the U.S. has to deal with how intelligence and security services deal with a very real and present threat at every level. The FBI has warned of armed protests in Washington and at state capitals in the days leading up to Biden's inauguration. This comes in light of the January 6th siege of the D.C. Capitol by supporters of outgoing President Donald Trump. U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar has announced his resignation, citing last week's deadly siege of the Capitol by supporters of President Donald Trump. U.S. media say that Azar has informed Trump of his decision in a letter in which he called the Capitol incident an assault on democracy. Azar also reportedly cited some successes of the administration, including rapid development of COVID vaccines, but said that the attack would tarnish these legacies. This is while the Trump administration has been heavily criticized for its dealing with the virus or the vaccine's distribution strategy. Azar's resignation is the latest in a series of departure of presidential aides and cabinet officials over the Capitol violence just days before Trump leaves the White House himself. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Muhammad Iqbal, also famously known as Allama Iqbal, was a famous poet, philosopher, lawyer, and politician. Muhammad Iqbal is called the spiritual father of Pakistan, as he is believed to be the inspiration behind the historical Pakistan movement, in which he was one of the few leaders who first conceived the idea of Pakistan as a different nation for the Muslims. Iqbal is Pakistan's national poet, and his birthday is a public holiday in Pakistan. Muhammad Iqbal, also known as Iqbal Lahori, is considered one of the most important figures in Urdu literature, with literary work in both the Urdu and Persian languages. Although Urdu poetry draws heavily on Persian idiom and imagery, Iqbal found Persian more suited to his thought and temperament, and a better means of communication to a wider audience in the Indian subcontinent as well as other countries of the Muslim world. At the end, more than half and nearly two-thirds of Iqbal's poetry was in Persian language. Stay with us as this week's program looks into this extraordinary man's life and legacy.
The fragrance of the companion shall take a nation to the companion. Sometimes childhood memories appear before my eyes like a pale pall of imagination. Among those rippling images there sails the craft of my thought towards the shore of silence, to anchor in the harbor of its own. I dwell on my existence. I want to decipher the oriental thoughts and secrets, and to put an end to my bewilderment and self-alienation. I am a traveler, standing on the shore of thoughts. My aim, to pinpoint my lost identity. I am a traveler, walking on the road of human thoughts. My destination is the land of belief in oneself, in a bid to revive an identity which might no longer exist. It is an identity which, like a child's toy, is played with, but in a deadly way.
Some ignorant guys sent to the slaughterhouse of death every day thousands of innocent people, because they are deeply buried in the marsh of their jejune ideas. In a way, there are two types of travels, a physical one, or going from one place to another, and a spiritual one, or transforming from one mood to another. Those embarking on the first type are many in number, and those embarking on the second type are much less. My travel is a mixture of both. Within the land and the sky, a travel in time to appreciate the ideas of an Eastern philosopher, namely Allama Muhammad Iqbal, the thinker, that if his thoughts were well understood, we would not witness the ignorant behaviors by takfiri groups that are far from Islamic injunctions and humanity these days. Allama Iqbal wrote great mysteries in his books for his son, Javed Iqbal, and all others. As an old man, Javed knows it well whom his father was addressing. Javed talks to him like this.
Right now, I am 90 years old. You don't address people of my age. You address young people. You like them to believe what I say. I personally cannot fully understand you. I follow a path not wanted by you. Talk to me, who is 90 years old. You feel the elderly usually talk in a desperate way. You advise that one should not be desperate. The right man is hidden in you. Go on with your search. He will surely appear. You are saying the same thing. You have not visited me. I did my best. I searched for 90 years, but I did not find that right man. Where is he then? Tell me if you know.
I begin my journey right from here to the city of Sialkot, the birthplace of Iqbal. Perhaps in this travel, I would be able to show some special features of that righteous man. Today, Sialkot is a city in Punjab, Pakistan. The city, when Iqbal was born, was part of India.
Oh, you who are familiar with me, come with me to the childhood alleys. Tread on memory's pathway. Come with me to my intimate alley, in my childhood home, on roofs quite stranger to all noises. May they be merrily remembered. The period of harmony with existence and excellence. The pleasant period of being with a companion, with all its liveliness. During all the year's generous moments, those alleys full of love, the splash of pure wafers.
ये वो घर है जहाँ अल्लामा इकबाल 9 November 1877 को सुबह पांच.
Here is the very room wherein Iqbal was born on the 9th of November 1877 at 5:14 a.m.
उन्होंने इस घर की इब्तिदा की.
The house here was built by his grandfather, Sheikh Muhammad Rafiq. He was the first to occupy the house. On the 6th of February, 1861, he bought three small rooms and a house near here until Iqbal was born. Later, Iqbal's elder brother came here. The house has undergone no change since then.
Iqbal's ancestors were high-ranking Brahmins of Kashmir. They converted to Islam 500 years before Iqbal was born. The family was called Siparu, meaning educated. His father was a cloth dealer. Nur Muhammad's shop was frequented by great thinkers of Islamic sects. His mother, Imam Bibi, was also a religious woman. Iqbal had one brother and four sisters, all of them his senior.
Rooms were built before anything else in 1861. Iqbal's family prepared the first room for the wives. There, in that room, you see a cradle and a chair.
Encouraged by his father, Muhammad Iqbal learned the Quran from his very childhood in Hisamuddin Mosque of Kashmiris. Basic lessons were learned at home, as Iqbal says this was the best period of his lifetime, because under his father's support, his thinking foundations became established. Sialkot's graveyard tells years later, when his father died, the story of Iqbal's attachment.
So many times I've asked myself, what is existence? From where does it take root? What a secret it is that has attracted thinkers' attention. I could not find answers to those questions. Then, many years later, when my thoughts expanded, I traveled back to my childhood to find answers to my questions. There it was my father who decided on the shape a thing should take. Years later, when unknown things became clear to me, I came to understand Mir Hassan's teachings. He talked to me about the Book of Life, but he did not mention the book's title. A condition set before me by him was this: to learn new sciences Europeans learn. It is only then that you come to know what the value of the Book of Life is. He was quite right. Years later, with all my heart, I came to fully know the Book of Life. The Book of Life, the Holy Quran, whose wisdom is eternal and solid. It is an illustration for life secrets. Its power makes the unfaithful faithful. To mankind, it is the only message. The bearer of it will enjoy the mercy of both worlds. Bandits turn into leaders just through its memorization. They become pious just with the help of this very book. He whose heart's pulsation is a result of the book's warmth, his restless way finds comfort just as does a pearl. Should you want to live a Muslim life, only through the Quran is this possible.
Sialkot, a city in northeastern Punjab province, located at the foot of the snow-clad Kashmiri mountain. It was here, in this crowded city, where Allama Iqbal's first educational basis took root. Having received his first training by father and such a great teacher as Maulana Mir Hassan, the young Muhammad entered Scotch Mission School to start his official education therein. The school's premises, against passage of centuries, keeps the same shape as it used to have.
He finished his high school here in 1891. Then in 1893, he completed his 10th grade, and it was here where he finally ended his high school education in 1895 and got his high school diploma.
Having finished his high school in Sialkot, Muhammad Iqbal found the city too small to give him an opportunity to fly higher up in the sky. Muhammad was 18 when he finished his pre-university courses with honors, receiving 2 academic gold medals. Admitted on a scholarship, he left Sialkot for Lahore as advised by his teacher Mir Hassan. Lahore was a city southwest of his birthplace, 125 kilometers away from it. Then Muhammad Iqbal went to Punjab University, one of Pakistan's oldest universities, established in 1882 by the British ruler of the Indian subcontinent in Lahore. There, the instruction language was English, though some lessons were taught in Urdu. Young Iqbal of Sialkot went there to continue his education. Very soon, he got so famous throughout the world due to his thoughts and his Persian Urdu poems. Known as Iqbal Lahori, he was destined to get his BA and MA here and composed his earliest poems.
Allama Iqbal bila shubah hamari islami duniya ka Undoubtedly, Iqbal is, for us in the world of Islam, a clear metaphor and a great name. Iqbal found an Islamic world, a special thought. At the present time, we are living in a place so blessed as it witnessed Iqbal, the learned, for 5 years. At a time when Iqbal arrived here from Sialkot to enroll for BA, the state university here had this one dormitory only. Iqbal lived here for 5 years. I mean, his presence here lasted about 5 years. He then enrolled for MA in philosophy. He completed his MA.
Iqbal, as it seems to me, went through two periods in his life, a wisdom period and a love period.
During the time Iqbal was still in the subcontinent, and when he had not yet left for the West, he was naturally well acquainted with Western philosophy, had deeply studied Hinduism and Islamic thoughts.
At that time, Iqbal was quite familiar with Indian mysticism, and the traces of that school of thought can be found in his poems.
He studied in depth our religion, and with such a deep knowledge, he left for the West.
There was no ending to the stories of my restlessness and abandoning similar places. I was 28 when recommended by my teacher, Sir Thomas Arnold, I left for Europe to continue my studies. Having a master's degree in philosophy, I had taught at the Oriental College, but going to England and starting study at Cambridge University for a doctorate in philosophy changed everything. Studying at Cambridge secured me opportunities to know better and more about Western philosophers. At the same time, I enrolled at the Faculty of Law to be able to get permission to act as attorney. The rest had no meaning to me. For that very year, I traveled to Hamburg, Germany, to do more research and finish my doctoral dissertation. For a whole year, I worked so hard to get fully familiar with philosophical foundations and to get my doctoral thesis finished. At that time, I made much of well-known philosophy teachers, such as the famous professor of philosophy, Mac Nagrad, and the famous Orientalist, Reinhold Elin Nicholson.
He continued his university studies in Heidelberg, Germany, and became familiar with the thoughts and ideas of such philosophers as Nietzsche, Fichte, Schopenhauer, and the like. There were similarities between his thoughts and the thoughts of those learned men.
Iqbal continues to say that he was changing and thinking those days.
Interestingly enough, Iqbal was influenced by Western philosophers. He adopted their thoughts and opinions. He received ideas from them, but mixed them with his own to create an independent thought system and called it own philosophy.
Having received his Doctor of Philosophy, Iqbal returned at the age of 31 to Lahore. Never did he hesitate to return home, contrary to some students of that time. He left England quickly He was then licensed to practice attorneyship and became a member of Lahore Bar Association. 3 years later, he became a lecturer in philosophy at Lahore University. He resigned after a while to exclusively practice as an attorney. This way, he was able to freely publish his thoughts. He continuously thought about finding a way to awaken Muslims taken captive by colonialism.
All my life has been coincident with the Indian subcontinent's darkest days. British colonialism and now World War I. India was dominated by colonialism since the 18th century. But as World War I began in August 1914, a new form of cruelty began to cover my land. Indians went to fight a war wherein they had played no role. They were killed and killed for people who themselves were the main factor in bringing ruin and destruction to the whole world. Description of troubles brought about by those calamities is actually impossible.
In 1910 and 1911, and after World War I, we see a number of liberation movements. Muslims rose against British and European colonizers. So Iqbal found himself on a well-defined route. He started composing revolutionary poems.
After World War I, in 1918, and the fall of the Ottoman Empire, something had to be done quickly to save people of the tyranny imposed on them. I knew that a worldwide caliphate was no longer practicable. There was no agreement between Islamic unity and blind religious prejudice or extreme nationalistic ideas as promulgated by colonial powers. Unwillingly, I engaged in political activities. I tried to raise public awareness to bring about self-reliance.
Allama ran for Punjab Parliament election. As he said, he hated political activities and Muslims' needs forced him to enter the political arena. Consequently, he joined the Muslim League Party. He succeeded to become an MP for Punjab province for 3 years. During that time, he tried to solve Muslims' problems. Iqbal used to talk on such problems.
Allama Iqbal nurtured the wish for an independent Pakistan. He would say a new country, an Islamic country, would come into existence on the world map. The country's name, he would say, will be Pakistan. Iqbal did not give this name to a new country, but surely he had it as a Muslim country in mind.
During my lifetime, I liked those sleeping in the world of thought to wake up from their deep sleep. But sadly, the sleep is too deep. Therefore, I took refuge in the world of rhythmic words and meaningful poems to awaken the youths of this sorrowful nation in order to sail the craft of our thoughts to the shore of productivity. I was a young man when I found out that to weather horrible tempests and the enemy's lurking place, we had no way but recourse to the miracle of the last time. The Holy Quran, the book with miraculous words, which can be used as the best means to awaken thought and exalt the belief in self. The book is most succoring, particularly to the youth. I, who despair of the sages of old, have a word to say touching the day to come. Render my speech easy unto the young, make my abbas for them attainable.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters all across the globe, wherever you are, and whenever it is that you are listening to this show. One of the important, one of the salient and prominent qualities of a good Muslim is, in fact, tolerance. Never has it been seen through history, never has it been reported in any book, in any source, that Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wa sallam or the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam were intolerant, were easily aggravated, were hostile or abusive toward people outside of their school of thought, their religion. Never. So if we're going to take them as our role models, and if we're going to hold them as the lanterns that guide us through the darker moments of life, we have to step into their footsteps, and we have to follow their example, especially when it comes to treating people that we don't necessarily agree with. One of the examples that people often talk about regarding this matter is that of Ayatollah Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Revolution, especially during his time outside of Iran in France at Nifel Le Chapon. He was a great example of coexistence. He was a great example of being at peace with people who don't agree with your religion. And he was a very good example of how you don't necessarily have to go and invite everyone to Islam. He was a Medija, and probably he had the most knowledge regarding Islam and Islamic fiqh and Islamic rulings and history and narrations and this and that than anyone else in all of France. But he didn't find the need to go door to door and say, "Can we introduce you to our Lord and Savior? Would you like to embrace Islam? Here's a pamphlet about my religion. Why don't you read that? And let me tell you about what's going to happen to you if you don't believe in Islam and how you're going to burn in hell for all of eternity." Sometimes that's needed. Sometimes that's the manifestation, that's the example of coexisting. And we need to understand that. And we're going to be right back after this short little story regarding Imam Khomeini.
The title of today's story is Imam Ruhullah Musavi Khomeini. French physician Dr. Louis, who was in his teens in the closing month of 1978, when the Imam Khomeini made the Paris suburb of Neuf-le-Château, says, "That day, when my father returned home from work, he angrily took off his coat and said, 'This year I have been stalked by misfortune. On one hand, the company is facing bankruptcy, and on the other, our suburb has lost its peace.' My mother consoled him, saying, 'Don't worry, it is said that Ayatollah Khomeini will leave within some days to Iran.' Louis adds, 'I was curious to see this great religious leader of Iran who was in our neighborhood. I joined reporters who were daily converging on the area and went to the edge of the orchard where Imam Khomeini was staying. I saw an old but enlightened man in robes sitting cross-legged under a shady tree and talking in cool and calm voice. Dr. Louis continues, I told my father that if he wanted to see a personality who inspired the same feelings as Jesus, peace be upon him, then he should come and hear Ayatollah Khomeini. I finally managed to convince my father, and the next day we went together to see this great spiritual leader from Iran. Ayatollah Khomeini's punctuality very much impressed me. He came on time and sat at the usual place where he used to meet the press. Minutes later, I looked at my father's face. He was listening carefully, and it was apparent that he was very much impressed by Ayatollah Khomeini. A few days later, it was Christmas. We sat for the celebrations when the doorbell suddenly rang. A man with a bouquet of flowers and package of confectionery was standing at the door. He greeted us cheerfully and handed to my father the bouquet and the confectionery, saying, "This is a present from Ayatollah Khomeini." He congratulated us on the birthday of Jesus and asked forgiveness if he had disturbed our Christmas celebration. Oh, my father thanked the man and stood amazed at all this love and affection from a Muslim divine.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
I'm not entirely sure who Dr. Louis is, and to be honest, I looked up his name and I couldn't find anything. But if we take this story as some sort of anecdote with lessons within it to be learned, it would still make sense. And parts of it are actually true and they really occurred and they're historically authentic. Such as the fact that Imam Khomeini, Ayatollah Khomeini, Rahmatullah Alayh, gave out sweets and, you know, small gifts to his Christian neighbors during Christmas as an act of tolerance, you know, as if you want to claim that your religion is all about peace, it's all about coexistence, if you want to claim that my religion isn't different from the religion that Jesus Christ, peace be upon him, brought forth and the prophets before him, you kind of got to prove it, you know, and reaching out to your neighbors during a time that is sacred, that is important to them, and making them feel good through a kind and sweet gesture is one of the greatest ways to express your religion. Just like Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam has said in a narration, that be a means and a source of beauty for us. Don't embarrass us. Or the other hadith that, again, Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam says, that preach people or invite people toward religion through means other than your tongue. By that act of kindness and peacemaking, Imam Khomeini basically engraved something into the minds and the hearts of his Christian neighbors during that period he lived in France. And it was that I might be a clergy, I might be a political figure, I might be a spiritual leader for many, I might be the center of the world's attention, and I might have been so for the past few years and for the next few years as well, but that doesn't mean that I can't abide by ethical, moral, humane rules regarding ethics and kindness toward other human beings. This act basically showed us that we're never above kindness, no matter how important we are, no matter how busy we are, and no matter what our achievements are in life. Because at the end of the day, even if we're king of the world, and we've earned that position through tears, blood, and sweat, it doesn't mean a darn thing if we cannot express kindness and empathy and benevolence toward our fellow human beings. At the end of the day, what makes us a valuable human is how we make other people feel. Sure, contributing to the level of their intelligence and their knowledge and helping them become smarter and gaining more information is really important. But again, if that information and knowledge that we impart to them doesn't help with making them kinder toward themselves and other human beings and other life forms, then what use is it really? That's all the time we have for today's episode of The Lantern. Thank you so very much for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.